Someone flippantly remarked that if you remember the 60s and psychedelics, you weren't there. If you even suspect that you were there, please don't worry about it, because don't worry about remembering more than you should, you see. Sometimes that does happen, because these were exciting years. And as a consequence, that strange and incomparable time has become a kind of historical Swiss cheese whose holes are stuffed with hearsay, fantasy, and misinformation. I think I was there. When I get a bit shaky and I can't trust my memory, I look around at the stuff I've accumulated over the past quarter century. And then I know I was there, and that's reassuring, I can tell you. In addition to a jungle of books, newspaper clippings, taped interviews and correspondence, there are a lot of unusual artifacts that seem to be appropriate for a time capsule that might help future generations piece together the puzzle that is the historical record of the first century of scientific consciousness exploration. Thank you very much. There's a long, fairly well tradition of humanity's attempts to transcend ordinary consciousness. There's a great deal we know about that, and it's been written on that, including religious, shamanic, and mystical methods in all of this. But the beginnings of what might be a modern era seems to have been ushered in about a half century ago this year, because it was in 1938 that LSD was first synthesized. So this is a very auspicious occasion, and we should pay homage to it. When Albert Hofmann, as we all know, a Swiss chemist, first synthesized a substance of unprecedented potency, the first of his many contributions to the discovery of these psychically transforming agents. So it really is appropriate to name this project, or to honor his name, by naming the project the Albert Hofmann Foundation. If we were to further look through our time capsule, we would find evidences of other milestones in this journey, some of which were provided by the speakers and some members of the audience here tonight. So you see, there's a kind of very up-to-dateness about all this. Here's a movement that's shaken the culture, and can you imagine that there is still a good number of the original progenitors of this movement that are still here with us today? That can only happen in a time of enormously accelerated events. Perhaps if we looked at this time capsule, there may be photographs and transcripts of Dr. Hofmann's first public American talk, which was in Santa Cruz in 1977. And this was after a decade after these substances were outlawed and had virtually disappeared from clinical research. Now that's rather interesting, because this did not depend on the fervor of people, taking drugs. They may have taken them surreptitiously, but at least we know that this was a quiescent period, but things, however, as we'll soon see, did not change nevertheless. And it says here to go to B, so I gotta go to B. All right, so give me a minute, I'll find out what happens in B, because I don't remember. Let's see. You know what, I didn't even put out where B was, so I gotta, so I gotta find out. It says, there at Santa Cruz, in the psychology department at the university, they said, well, okay, you want to have a meeting at Albert Hofmann, you know, who's ever heard of this stuff and so on. Remember, 10 years, nobody's been able to take it. Nobody's been able to take it legally, I should say. And no research is done and all that kind of stuff. So they provided a token hall of about 600 people. And without much formal notice, 4,000 people showed up. And nobody knew what to do. They had to take the campus police back from their dinners and so on. They have to round up all these people. They were all legitimate, quiet, that they all wanted to hear Albert Hofmann. So we were sitting in this little hall, and these people were so anxious to hear him that their faces were pressed against the window panes. I felt this odd sensation that we were in a sort of an aquarium with everybody who was watching us from the outside. And so this unexpected outpouring of interest was further repeated at an art exhibit on psychedelics and creativity that I held about 2 years ago. And similarly, we sent about 600 invitations and we got 4,500 inquiries. So that should tell us something. Now, where do I have to go from here? I can find out. This overwhelming response confirmed that there was a resurgence in the area of conscious change that was not just going away, and that we had tapped once again into a current of age-old significance. It then became evident, and it really became clear, that we needed to collect, document, and safeguard this present legacy. This was very important. It was not just a flash in the pan. It was something that we were privileged to see again in its more modern form, perhaps, and we have the obligation to preserve it. So, with that in mind, I got all fired up and I wrote to my colleagues and the many people who made contributions to the early work and so on, and their names are listed in the program because they became our board of advisors. A word or two about this. We put down every person we could think of that had made some contribution to that early research, and we covered everyone, including the people in Prague, the people in Stockholm, and the Karolinska, and so on, all the people we could think of, and we wrote to them thinking, well, we'll get a few back. Every single one of them answered enthusiastically. Not one single person, and now many of these people were distinguished emeritus professors. There was Schultes at Harvard, for example. There was Bo Holmsted at the names you may not know, at the Karolinska, brilliant researchers and so on, all said, go for it. It's very important that this be done. Nobody recanted. Nobody said, oh, that was just a bit of foolishness I indulged in when I was younger or something like that. Now, you can well imagine how good that made us feel. They were most generous and supportive and offered much of their materials and said, when you have a place, we'll send our stuff down and we'll offer you whatever guidance you need. And so with their help, and their very evident help, and the help of others, we began to consider developing a foundation or an organization. Again, which we call the Albert Hofmann Foundation, and it is chaired by our chairman of the board of directors, Robert Zanger. It was a freestanding nonprofit organization. Now, the word freestanding simply means that we're not associated with an institution, because one of the notions was, well, maybe UCLA or one of the other places would give us a berth, but we know by experience that's kind of the kiss of death if you want to retain any autonomy or any kind of self-sufficiency. So it's a freestanding nonprofit organization whose purpose is to provide an informational center based in Los Angeles and to devoted to the study of human consciousness. The basic and most important principle of this foundation, and it's the one that I insisted from the beginning, is that it must be free of any doctrinaire or political position of any kind, and it must serve as a forum where these controversial issues can finally be examined on neutral ground. We currently plan that a library gallery will be operational by the end of the year, at which time you will be invited to visit and review this unique collection of thousands of books, articles, and other memorabilia related to this unprecedented time that touched so many of our lives. Now, you may not know, but 2 or 3 or more thousand scientific articles have been written about LSD. You may be surprised to know what a wealth of information there is. And therefore, whenever I'm in the position of taking questions from an audience in there, I'm always puzzled by the fact that so many of these questions can be answered if we had a place where these people could go and answer those questions for themselves. At this point, you may ask, well, what about the time-honored methods that have provided vehicles for consciousness change without drug use? In other words, are we simply, is this only going to be a repository for information about consciousness change using various agents and so on? Then it would be a contradiction in terms. Obviously not. It so happened that this was my introduction into it, and I'm sure others. And to be totally candid, I don't know that I would have been introduced to this in any other fashion. So I'm much indebted for myself for that. And so what about those other things? And how can we then look for a place that all aspects of consciousness change, not those, just those that are related to drug use? And that is the singular and sole purpose of the Albert Hofmann Foundation. And we ask you all to consider carefully that the moves we make here tonight, because this is really a kind of a forerunner kind of meeting. It's beginning to the opening gun for this process, to consider carefully what your own personal roles might be in wanting to see such a place, what questions you would like to have answered, and just, if nothing else, to luxuriate in all of the things that went on that have been so generously contributed to us by the people who have made this possible. Thank you so much.
When I first went to Millbrook, I realized how American it was that Richard Alpert, Timothy Leary, and Ralph Metzner were Catholic, Protestant, and Jewish, you know, just with psychedelic overtones. And but we had the American religious trilogy there. And it's my pleasure now to introduce a man who was the Protestant member of that triumvirate, and who talked to dead people even before it was trendy. Here's Ralph Metzner.
Well, I feel strange at looking out. I can't see you. Could that light be down a little bit? It seems very glaring right in my eyes. I am honored to be here and asked to say a few things at this occasion. I feel I don't really have that much to say compared to my two illustrious friends and colleagues, whom you're going to hear from later on in this evening. I did have the pleasure of working with Timothy Leary and Richard Alpert during the 60s, and perhaps thought I would tell you a few things that I learned during that time. Actually, when listening to Oscar Janaga, I was reminded of this occasion at the University of Santa Cruz that he described when there was a gathering of people honoring Albert Hofmann and discussing the status of psychedelic research 10 years afterwards. And at that time, I did a little experiment with the group, which if you're willing to do, I might suggest that we do right now a little experiment in consciousness alteration. It's very, very simple. It doesn't involve any drugs. And it goes like this. As you know, consciousness is very connected with memory. And memory is dependent on your state of consciousness. So when you're sad, you remember the sad events that you experienced before, and when you're happy, you remember the happy events you experienced before. So what I'd like to suggest is that allow your memory to come up with a time when you had a psychedelic experience that was extremely high or extremely positive, extremely expansive. And just allow yourself to, for a moment, to re-experience that experience in memory, how you felt emotionally and how your body felt physically and what thoughts, if any, you were having, what the consciousness was like. Just allowing yourself to re-experience that as fully as possible, perhaps also the senses, the visual field that you were experiencing, and the sounds and the touch. Just allow that to come back into your present moment and notice whether something doesn't begin to happen to your state of awareness. Anyway, it's like a little meditation. So what I thought I would do in the time that I have is briefly tell you some aspects of my story, basically why am I here? And you may wonder, well, who cares, really? I think the reason for that, the answer to that would be, well, perhaps some aspects of my story are stories that you yourself may also have lived in part or have a resonance to, or it may trigger something in you, hopefully. So I met Timothy Leary and Richard Alpert when I was at Harvard. I was a graduate student there. This is actually the first time that the three of us have been in one event, I think, in over 25 years. And the two of them actually did a reunion a few years back on the 20th anniversary of their being fired from Harvard. People, I wasn't at that because I wasn't fired from Harvard. People used to assume that I was fired from Harvard too, and I always had to point out, well, I wasn't fired, I didn't have a job there, I was just a graduate student. Then subsequently, I changed my story because I realized it was much more interesting and people admired me more if I could say I was fired from Harvard, so I would just say, well, yes, all right, I was fired too. So, but basically what we were doing in those days in what was known as the Harvard Project was research in states of consciousness and their applications. These were in the days when Timothy and Richard were still psychologists. Which they have since transformed into something else, which I'm sure they'll be able to tell you in much greater detail what that is than I could possibly hope to do. And we were doing psychological research and in states of consciousness and their value to prisoners in a prison. And because of Timothy Leary's philosophy of research, which was collaborative, and he, I thought, very nobly, sincerely, nobly, refused to treat the prisoners in a prison like guinea pigs by giving them a drug and observing them, as is the usual kind of clinical psychological practice, but instead, since this was a very profound kind of sacramental experience as we thought of it, as we had experienced it, he said, well, we will share the experience with you. Some of us will, faculty and psychologists and students will take the drug with the prisoners and then will change places, and some of them will also be the sitters and so forth. So as a result of that practice, which I think it was probably unique in itself in the history of that kind of research in prisons, it so turned out that my first psychedelic experience, possibly my first dozen or so psychedelic trips, actually took place in a maximum security prison, which was an interesting experience in many levels, in many ways. One of the interesting things we learned early on was that the usual stereotypes of criminals being these violent men, you know, the idea at that time was this drug releases the unconscious. So people would say, are you mad? You're going in there and you're going to release these violent men with their unconscious, and it'll be dangerous and so forth. And it actually, in, you know, hundreds of sessions, man-hour sessions and experiences that we witnessed and observed and participated in, there was never any violence. It was very interesting. Perhaps you might say, well, these people don't, you know, they're not really suppressing or repressing their violent impulses. They're there because they act them out. And so perhaps they're repressing something else. And that will come out. And that turned out to be true in the sense that the scenes that stick in my mind most memorably were scenes of people talking very intimately with each other, very serenely, peacefully, kindly, and people from different backgrounds. And also, I remember one particularly bruising, hardened criminal-looking type of person looking in rapture at photographs from the Family of Man book and of women with children, and tears were running down his eyes as he was looking at this. So experiences of tenderness and kindness and gentleness between people was perhaps the new terrain for them in these kinds of experiences. And other work that we did at that time was with artists, and of course the work Oscar Janiger was beginning to do, and other people on the West Coast were beginning to explore these substances too. And at one point, after leaving Harvard, we had a project in Zihuatanejo in Mexico, in which we attempted to set up a structure where people could learn how to use LSD and psychedelics most constructively to change their consciousness in a constructive direction. And for $200 a month inclusive, you could go down to Mexico and participate in this kind of experiment. This was in 1964. I remember it was actually headlined in the San Francisco Chronicle, $200 a month paradise. It was a good deal, you have to admit it. It didn't last very long because we were thrown out there and then tried to go to a number of different other Caribbean islands and so forth, and then ended up in a place in upstate New York known as Millbrook, a large, rambling building estate where we began to do, where we lived as a kind of a community. And during that time, it was interesting, there was a gradual change that took place, which was not always very comfortable for me as a very kind of conservative, cautious, experimental psychologist type by background and training. A shift from a group of people interested in pursuing certain kinds of psychological research in different states of consciousness, unusual states of consciousness, began to be very clearly had the dimensions of a social movement. by the end of the time, the several years that we were in Millbrook, or not even by the end, after a few years, Millbrook acquired a kind of a reputation, and there would sometimes be over 100 and 120, 50 guests come up from New York and just basically camp out in the grounds or in the various parts of the building and take large doses of LSD and follow their own journeys, whether it was became kind of a haven to do that, which of course caused a number of problems and difficulties, because at this time also the drug, as you know, was beginning to become notorious and rapidly illegal and socially unacceptable. But I think this was really one of the key significant transitions that took place over a long period of time, from a research movement to a social movement, a social change movement. And some of the things Paul was talking about, the interface between the consciousness research in the 60s and the political activism of the 60s, is an issue that has not really been very fully explored. It was recently explored in a book called Storming Heaven by Jay Stevens in quite an interesting way, but there are many aspects of that whole story that really have not yet fully been understood. I see in retrospect that our role in these early days, as we conceived it, was to try to find a way that these tools, consciousness tools as we thought of them, could be integrated into society. And and I feel that other, we were like the psychologists and philosophers who were trying to do it at that level. And other psychologists were also working on the West Coast doing that. And then there was another whole level of introduction of these substances into society, which was not from a research or science point of view at all, namely the Ken Kesey, Mary Prankster's acid tests kinds of phenomena, where 2,000 people would be together in a ballroom and dancing to the Grateful Dead under LSD. These were phenomena that we were completely baffled and unfamiliar with, at least for me personally, coming from a very kind of conservative East Coast environment. When I first came out here and witnessed one of these events, I must say, I was mind-boggled in many ways. In Millbrook, we did a lot of experimentation in community living, because one of the things we learned from the psychedelic experiences, as you no doubt know, is that the existing forms of thought, of relationship, tend to be challenged or questioned or suspended, and you begin to look at all aspects of your life and think, well, is this really how I want to live my life, or can I make changes that would be more fitting to the kind of experience that I'm now having, this kind of unitive experience. So we did a lot of perhaps rash, perhaps naive, perhaps misguided social and interpersonal experimentation with new forms of relationship in this community in Millbrook, which proved to be at times hilarious and at other times downright devastating. And it seemed over a period of time, from my perspective, that disintegrative forces, forces of a destructive nature, seemed to grow in strength. For me, this was symbolized one time when I had been in India for about 3 months pursuing some interest in yogic research. And when I came back to Millbrook and Timothy wasn't there, and also Richard Alpert wasn't there, and a whole group of people were there whom I scarcely knew. Some of them were people I'd known before. And one young man appeared at the door whom I didn't know. He was wearing my clothes that I had left behind. And I looked at him and I did a double take. It was very strange. And I began to really wonder what I was doing there and what was going on there. And we had all kinds of meetings and discussions and crises. And for me personally, it began to be more like a personal crisis there. So And during this time, this was in the middle to late 60s, I began to feel increasing dissatisfaction with the my own experiences with drugs also. It seemed like every time I would take a psychedelic, such as LSD, I would basically have the same experience. And so it wasn't really consciousness expanding anymore. I simply went to the same place. It was sometimes an okay place, sometimes not so good. And it was basically not new. So something in me said, well, you really have to stop this because this isn't going anywhere. And I think many people had that experience around that time after some years. And so I then went into a phase where for 9 or 10 years, I stayed away from any mind-altering substances altogether, completely, and studied various forms of therapy and various forms of meditation and yoga and non-drug ways of altering consciousness. I became involved in a school of Agni Yoga, Yoga of Fire, and I learned a distinction between something about being able to move in consciousness. And I began to appreciate more how the psychedelic drugs function as amplifiers, but not really as, there's nothing in those tools that allows you to actually process through, as we say nowadays, or work through, or change in a permanent way the underlying psychic structures. You transcend the psychic structures, and then you come back into them. This was the question, the issue Timothy used to refer to as re-imprinting. And Ram Dass has talked about this same dilemma many times. And so with these tools, I began to appreciate yogic tools as tools in consciousness in which you could learn to move. The medicine could amplify your understanding, your vision, your perception. But it wouldn't by itself give you a method. It's not a way. It doesn't have any inherent direction, so people like Charles Manson can use LSD and do what they did with it. There's nothing inherently good about the chemical that expands your consciousness. The good or the intention, the good that is done with it, depends on the intention of the individual, which is the notion that our group with Timothy Leary first formulated as the set and setting hypothesis. The notion that the intention and the context affects the nature of your experience. And that's true when you think about it, about any kind of experience you have, whether it's with LSD or anything else. It's the intention and the context that are the key determinants of what's going on. So if you pay attention to intention and to context, you have a way of making choices that are constructive and positive and expand your scope of thinking and acting and your give you greater room to be creative in new and productive ways, ways that are fruitful of growth for yourself and for other people. And so when I went into this phase of working with these non-drug methods, Timothy went off in his direction, and I followed his saga, extraordinary saga really, of jails and exiles in many countries. And I would like to say him something here in appreciation of Timothy, which is that this man, after going through these unbelievable experiences in many jails and many foreign countries, experiences that would be enough to shatter and depress anyone, certainly me, I would think if I had went through something like that, I would be a total wreck. Timothy has unbelievably high spirits. He has more than any other human being I've ever met the capacity to rebound from seeming adversity and to come up laughing and full of wise and humor. And he also has an amazing ability to relate to people of all walks of life, to really bring out and to connect with something in people that no matter who they may be, whether gangsters or criminals or bums or foreign politicians or local politicians, whatever. I sometimes have said to people when they've asked me about Timothy that for me he represents the mythic story of the court jester in ancient times. You know, the court jester at the court of kings was allowed to say things that were outrageous because he said them in a funny way. And then when you stopped laughing, you suddenly thought, oh, gee, that was really an interesting perspective. I never thought of it that way. And Timothy is a master of the outrageous statement. That he makes these outrageous statements, and then you think, well, that's really outrageous, that's ridiculous, you know. And then afterwards you think, I wonder if there isn't really something to that. So I see him as somehow playing this role of court jester, and many people will say, oh, he's completely nuts, he's taking too many drugs, and he's a menace to society, and so forth. And yet he inspires people, you know, inspires people with his capacity for vision and for seeing the potential and for encouraging people to let go of old, outworn habits and patterns. And for that, I'd very much like to acknowledge and express my deep appreciation to this man. And I would also like to express my appreciation for Ram Dass, formerly Richard Alpert, whom I've also had periodic contacts with over the years, who has also went off on his other path, on his path, which you've heard about and may hear more about, which has also impressed me incredibly. And the numbers of changes that he's gone through, from Harvard professor to Hindu sadhu to American folk guru. He is sort of, to me, the wandering monk, sadhu, a jolly monk, no doubt, one who loves funny stories and loves to carouse and have a good time, but nonetheless somebody who constantly teaches and helps people. I know more people, I have met more people in my practice, in my just everyday life, who have been deeply personally touched by Ram Dass through his writings, or through hearing him talk, or through actually him sitting with them in some crisis, or talking with them, or just staying with them. Being able to stay with them for a long time. You may know of his work with Stephen Levine and others, and working with the Dayan. Wonderful work that he's done there. Really opened up a whole new field of being with dying people. And also his work with the Seva Foundation, which does work with blindness in third world country and raising money for that. I can't forbear to tell you a story that happened this afternoon when I was at Tim's house, and we were talking about Ram Dass before he got there, and I mentioned that Ram Dass had been in San Francisco, and we talked, and he was working with AIDS patients and constantly going off to meet with an AIDS patient and sit with somebody who was going through a crisis. And then later on, we talked we were talking again about Ram Dass, and I mentioned the work of the Seva Foundation and his work. And Timothy said, well, pretty soon he's going to run out of diseases. And I thought that was really a wonderful statement, because Richard is somebody who helps people who are suffering. In that way, Timothy is different. Timothy inspires people to, through his humor and his brilliance and his wit and his vision, to look for new possibilities. Ram Dass reaches out to people where they are, and especially if they're hurting, and tries to hold them by the hand and moves them along, helps them move along a little bit. So I'd like to express my deep appreciation to you also, Ramdas, for the work that you do. I don't know how much time I have left, but I'll just say a couple of remarks about what my present views are on psychedelics. I think I've said already I regard them as tools, as basically as amplifiers. They're not in itself, they do not in itself show you a way to live. They are not in itself a spiritual discipline. You may be able to use them in a spiritual discipline, and you may also be able to abuse them and misuse them in various ways, well known to all. I think the need for the a place like the Albert Hofmann Foundation is evident because of the facts that Oskar Janiger mentioned, that really scientific research has come to a standstill, and the fact that the scientific research that did happen in the 60s led to something that was more than science. It led to this social change movement, or at least it played an essential role in this social change movement, the full effects of which I don't believe we're even going to feel yet. Except perhaps some people actually believe that the full effects of the changes that began in the 60s will not actually come into legal and political institutional form until the 90s. Because it's by that time that potentially the people that were that lived their early youth and young adult lives in the 60s, the baby boomers, post-war baby boomers generation who had these idealistic visions, by that time those people will be in the 90s will be in a majority in Congress. So it's quite possible that some of the, you know, there have been many institutional and legal changes, but then they tend to get watered down after a while. And it's possible that some of them will be reinstated in a new way with more commitment. So I feel that this is important, and I think the work of something like the Hofmann Foundation in documenting in an archival way this historical movement is very, very valuable. There is this question of which remains, which is how can such substances be integrated into society? And maybe they can't. For years and years, I puzzled over this question. How were the Native American Indians able to integrate peyote into their culture and be able to this day to use it as a religious sacrament, legally protected by the Constitution and the courts? And the white people were not able to do that. We were not able to find a social form within which these substances could be handled. We tried it within psychology and psychiatry, within religion, within the arts. It didn't work. It was too much, as Timothy and Richard used to say. It's too threatening, too much, too soon, too powerful. One answer to that question that has intrigued me for years that I recently came to understand through my studies and my work with Native American people and studies of some of their practices, not only the peyote ritual but also other practices such as the sweat lodge, and is that, and I think I understand now why we weren't able to do it and they were, and the understanding that I got was that for them these practices and rituals are completely, they're an integration of body, mind, and spirit. In other words, the man in the peyote ritual or in the sweat lodge is having physical healing. He goes into it for physical healing. He goes in for it for psychological therapy and problem solving for himself and his family. And he goes in it for worship. So it's a church as well. So it's an integration of religious, psychological, and physical, medical concerns. And in our culture, we don't have that kind of integration. We have separate professions, separate interest groups, completely separate worlds of religion, of science, of psychology, and of medicine. And the lesson to that for me is that a powerful substance like that can only be contained within an integrative framework. And so the challenge that I see, which we may not be able to meet, is can we devise, or will a integrative framework ever be developed? I think a lot of changes have to take place in the society before we'll be at that point. The one other last point I would like to make in terms of ways in which some of my views have changed since the 60s is in this question of synthetic drugs versus natural organic plant substances or medicines. And I used to, in the 60s, as many others say, well, the mescaline that's in the peyote cactus is exactly the same mescaline molecule as is synthesized in the laboratory, therefore there shouldn't be any difference. I now no longer feel this is true. And in fact feel quite the opposite, that the distinction between those two is very important, and that I feel that from a research point of view in psychology, pharmacology, and medicine, see, the usual structure is we go to third world countries like South America, Africa, in other words, and we find these plants, and then we bring the plants back, and we the drug companies try to analyze them and find drugs that might be valuable as antibiotics or whatever it may be, and extract them and synthesize them. And it may, in fact, what I now feel would be a much more productive direction to take, which a few of colleagues that I know are beginning to take, is to try to recover and retain as much of the knowledge of these plants and the way that they are used in the traditional cultures and bring that to this culture, the whole framework, the whole pattern. Because it's much more likely to be safe that way. I think you all understand the difference between coca leaf chewing in the Andes and cocaine snorting in the Western cities. Is a big difference in safety. And the same can be expected to be true of other things. Now you may say, well, if that's the case, would you ever use synthetics at all? What would be the point of using something like LSD? Well, I've come to the conviction that really from a research strategy point of view, if a synthetic drug is discovered that has promising effects on the mind, then our task should be to go out and try to find a plant that contains that or a similar substance and use that plant as a medicine, as an herbal medicine. I think this is tied into the shift to a growing interest in herbal medicine, natural medical methods, healing methods. And in the case of LSD, it's also very interesting that because of the work that Hoffman and others did to show that in all likelihood, the mysteries of Eleusis, the great goddess religion of ancient Greece, which was the dominant religious initiatory school, mystery school in Greece for 2,000 years before it was wiped out by Christianity, may very well have involved the use of a preparation from ergot, which is the fungus that grows on rye and wheat, from which LSD is semi-synthetically derived. And it may very well be that if we were able to recover the method of utilizing this plant, this fungus, directly in a way that doesn't have the toxic side effects that it usually does, as it might have been used at Eleusis, we would be able to recapture something of the spirit of this ancient tradition. This is one of my interests in general right now, is to try to do as much as I can to preserve lost knowledge or knowledge that is in the danger of being imminently lost. And I'm not particularly optimistic about the revival of scientific research as we know it about psychedelics taking place in any foreseeable future. But I do see the possibility of a much more subtle, widespread change to a greater interest in herbs, natural foods, natural plants, natural substances, and natural ways, traditional ways, ways of the earth wisdom cultures that we have lost and forgotten, including our own ancestral ways, the pre-Christian European traditions, for example. Christianity did an unbelievable hatchet job on the ancient animistic nature religions of Europe. As it has done later on in North America with the American Indians' beliefs, and is now beginning to dawn on many people that there is a great deal of wisdom and knowledge there that we need desperately to preserve and recover if we're going to maintain our sanity in an increasingly insane world. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Ralph.